Half an hour later, the sun rose again, and Brian felt his sanity give a deep shudder and slide closer to the edge of its own abyss. The world below was gone, utterly and finally gone. The deepening blue sky was a dome over a cyclopean ocean of deepest, purest ebony. The world had been torn from beneath Flight 29. Bethany's thought had also crossed Brian's mind. If push came to shove, if worse came to worst, he had thought, he could put the 767 into a dive and crash them into a mountain, ending it for good and all. But now there were no mountains to crash into. Now there was no earth to crash into. What will happen to us if we can't find the rip again, he wondered. What will happen if we run out of fuel? Don't try to tell me we'll crash, because I simply don't believe it. You can't crash into nothing. I think we'll simply fall, and fall, and fall. For how long, and how far? How far can you fall into nothing? Don't think about it. But how exactly did one do that? How did one refuse to think about nothing? He turned deliberately back to his sheet of calculations. He worked on them, referring frequently to the INS readout, until the light had begun to fade out of the sky again. He now put the elapsed time between sunrise and sunset at about 28 minutes. He reached for the switch that controlled the cabin intercom and opened the circuit. Nick, can you come up front? Nick appeared in the cockpit doorway less than 30 seconds later. Have they got their shades pulled back there? Brian asked him before he could come all the way in. You better believe it, Nick said. Very wise of them. I'm going to ask you not to look down yet, if you can help it. I'll want you to look out in a few minutes. And once you look out, I don't suppose you'll be able to help looking down, but I advise you to put it off as long as possible. It's not very nice. Gone, is it? Yes, everything. The little girl is gone too, Dinah. Laura was with her at the end. She's taking it very well. She liked that girl. So did I. Brian nodded. He was not surprised. The girl's wound was the sort that demanded immediate treatment in an emergency room, and even then the prognosis would undoubtedly be cloudy, but it still rolled a stone against his heart. He had also liked Dinah, and he believed what Laurel believed, that the girl was somehow more responsible for their continued survival than anyone else. She had done something to Mr. Toomey, had used him in some strange way, and Brian had an idea that, somewhere inside, Toomey would not have minded being used in such a fashion. So if her death was an omen, it was one of the worst sort. She never got her operation, he said. No. But Laurel is okay? More or less. You like her, don't you? Yes, Nick said. I have mates who would laugh at that, but I do like her. She's a bit dewy-eyed, but she's got grit. Brian nodded. Well, if we get back, I wish you the best of luck. Thanks. Nick sat down in the co-pilot's seat again. I've been thinking about the question you asked me before. About what I'll do when and if we get out of this mess. Besides taking the lovely Laurel to dinner, that is. I suppose I might end up going after Mr. O'Banion after all. As I see it, he's not all that much different from our friend Toomey. Dinah asked you to spare Mr. Toomey, Brian pointed out. Maybe that's something you should add into the equation. Nick nodded. He did this as if his head had grown too heavy for his neck. Maybe it is. Listen, Nick. I called you up front because if Bob's time rip actually exists, we've got to be getting close to the place where we went through it. We're going to man the crow's nest together, you and I. You take the starboard side and right center. I'll take port and left center. If you see anything that looks like a time rip, sing out. Nick gazed at Brian with wide, innocent eyes. Are we looking for a thingamabob type time rip, or do you think it'll be one of the more or less fuckadelic variety, mate? Very funny. Brian felt a grin touch his lips in spite of himself. I don't have the slightest idea what it's going to look like, or even if we'll be able to see it at all. If we can't, we're going to be in a hell of a jam if it's drifted to one side, or if its altitude has changed. Finding a needle in a haystack would be child's play in comparison. What about radar? Brian pointed to the RCATL color radar monitor. Nothing, as you can see. But that's not surprising. If the original crew had acquired the damn thing on radar, they never would have gone through it in the first place. They wouldn't have gone through it if they'd seen it either, Nick pointed out gloomily. That's not necessarily true. They might have seen it too late to avoid it. Jetliners move fast, and airplane crews don't spend the entire flight searching the sky for bogies. They don't have to. That's what ground control is for. 30 or 35 minutes into the flight, the crew's major outbound tasks are completed. The bird is up, it's out of L.A. airspace. The anti-collision honker is on and beeping every 90 seconds to show it's working. The INS is all programmed. That happens before the bird ever leaves the ground, and it is telling the autopilot just what to do. From the look of the cockpit, the pilot and co-pilot were on their coffee break. They could have been sitting here, facing each other, talking about the last movie they saw or how much they dropped at Hollywood Park. If there had been a flight attendant up front just before the event took place, there would at least have been one more set of eyes, but we know there wasn't. The mail crew had their coffee in Danish. The flight attendants were getting ready to serve drinks to the passengers when it happened. That's an extremely detailed scenario, Nick said. Are you trying to convince me or yourself? At this point, I'll settle for convincing anyone at all. Nick smiled and stepped to the starboard cockpit window. His eyes dropped involuntarily downward toward the place where the ground belonged, and his smile first froze, then dropped off his face. His knees buckled, and he gripped the bulkhead with one hand to steady himself. Shit on toast, he said in a tiny, dismayed voice. Not very nice, is it? Nick looked around at Brian. His eyes seemed to float in his pallid face. All my life, he said, I've thought of Australia when I heard people talk about the great bugger all, but it's not. That's the great bugger all, right down there. Brian checked the INS and the charts again quickly. He had made a small red circle on one of the charts. They were now on the verge of entering the airspace that circle represented. Can you do what I asked? If you can't, say so. Pride is a luxury. We can't... Of course I can, Nick murmured. He had torn his eyes away from the huge black socket below the plane and was scanning the sky. I only wish I knew what I was looking for. I think he'll know it when you see it, Brian said. He paused and then added, if you see it. Bob Jenkins sat with his arms folded tightly across his chest, as if he were cold. Part of him was cold, but this was not a physical coldness. The chill was coming out of his head. Something was wrong. He did not know what it was, but something was wrong. Something was out of place, or lost, or forgotten. Either a mistake had been made, or was going to be made. The feeling nagged at him like some pain not quite localized enough to be identified. That sense of wrongness would almost crystallize into a thought, and then it would skitter away like some small, not quite tame animal. Something wrong, or out of place, or lost, or forgotten. Ahead of him, Albert and Bethany were spooning contentedly. Behind him, Rudy Warwick was sitting with his eyes closed and his lips moving. The beads of a rosary were clamped in one fist. Across the aisle, Laurel Stevenson sat beside Dinah, holding one of her hands and stroking it gently. Wrong. Bob eased up the shade beside his seat, peeked out, and slammed it down again. Looking at that would not aid rational thought, but erase it. What lay below the plane was utter madness. I must warn them. I have to. They are going forward on my hypothesis. But if my hypothesis is somehow mistaken and dangerous, then I must warn them. Warn them of what? Again, it almost came into the light of his focused thoughts, then slipped away, becoming just a shadow among shadows, but one with shiny, feral eyes. He abruptly unbuckled his seatbelt and stood up. Albert looked around. Where are you going? Cleveland, Bob said grumpily, and began to walk down the aisle toward the tail of the aircraft, still trying to track the source of that interior alarm bell. Brian tore his eyes away from the sky, which was already showing signs of light again, long enough to take a quick glance first at the INS readout and then at the circle on his chart. They were approaching the far side of the circle now. If the time rip was still here, they should see it soon. If they didn't, he supposed he would have to take over the controls and send them circling back for another pass at a slightly different altitude and on a slightly different heading. It would play hell on their fuel situation, which was already tight. But since the whole thing was probably hopeless anyway, it didn't matter very... Brian! Nick's voice was unsteady. Brian! I think I see something! Bob Jenkins reached the rear of the plane, made an about face, and started slowly back up the aisle again, passing row after row of empty seats. He looked at the objects that lay in them and on the floor in front of them as he passed. Purses, pairs of eyeglasses, wrist watches, a pocket watch, two worn crescent-shaped pieces of metal that were probably heel taps, dental fillings, wedding rings. Something is wrong! Yes? Was that really so? Or was it only his overworked mind nagging fiercely over nothing? The mental equivalent of a tired muscle which will not stop twitching. Leave it, he advised himself, but he couldn't. If something really is amiss, why can't you see it? Didn't you tell that boy that deduction is your meat and drink? Haven't you written 40 mystery novels, and weren't a dozen of those actually quite good? Didn't Newgate Callender call The Sleeping Madonna a masterpiece of logic when he... Bob Jenkins came to a dead stop, his eyes widening. They fixed on a portside seat near the front of the cabin. In it, the man with the black beard was out cold again, snoring lustily. Inside Bob's head, the shy animal at last began to creep fearfully into the light. Only it wasn't small, as he had thought. That had been his mistake. Sometimes you couldn't see things because they were too small, but sometimes you ignored things because they were too big, too obvious. The sleeping Madonna. The sleeping man. He opened his mouth and tried to scream, but no sound came out. His throat was locked. Terror sat on his chest like an ape. He tried again to scream and managed no more than a breathless squeak. Sleeping Madonna, sleeping man. They, the survivors, had all been asleep. Now, with the exception of the bearded man, none of them were asleep. Bob opened his mouth once more, tried once more to scream, and once more nothing came out. Holy Christ, in the morning, Brian whispered. The time rip lay about 90 miles ahead, off to the starboard side of the 767's nose by no more than 7 or 8 degrees. If it had drifted, it had not drifted much. Brian's guess was that the slight differential was the result of a minor navigational error. It was a lozenge-shaped hole in reality, but not a black void. It cycled with a dim pink-purple light, like the aurora borealis. Brian could see the stars beyond it, but they were also rippling. A wide white ribbon of vapor was slowly streaming either into or out of the shape which hung in the sky. It looked like some strange ethereal highway.
We can follow it right in, Brian thought excitedly. It's better than an ILS beacon. We're in business, he said, laughed idiotically, and shook his clenched fists in the air.
It must be 2 miles across, Nick whispered. My God, Brian, how many other planes do you suppose went through?
I don't know, Brian said, but I'll bet you my gun and dog that we're the only one with a shot at getting back. He opened the intercom.
Ladies and gentlemen, we've found what we're looking for.
His voice crackled with triumph and relief. I don't know exactly what happens next, or how or why, but we have sighted what appears to be an extremely large trapdoor in the sky. I'm going to take us straight through the middle of it. We'll find out what's on the other side together. Right now, I'd like you all to fasten your seatbelts, and... That was when Bob Jenkins came pelting madly at the aisle, screaming at the top of his lungs.
No! No! We'll all die if you go into it! Turn back! You've got to turn back!
Brian swung around in his seat and exchanged a puzzled look with Nick. Nick unbuckled his belt and stood up.
That's Bob Jenkins, he said. Sounds like he's worked himself up to a good set of nerves. Carry on, Brian. I'll handle him.
Okay, Brian said. Just keep him away from me. I'd hate to have him grab me at the wrong second and send us into the edge of that thing. He turned off the autopilot and took control of the 767 himself. The floor tilted gently to the right as he banked toward the long, glowing slot ahead of them. It seemed to slide across the sky until it was centered in front of the 767's nose. Now he could hear a sound mixing with the drone of the jet engines, a deep, throbbing noise like a huge diesel idling. As they approached the river of vapor, it was flowing into the hole. He now saw, not out of it. He began to pick up flashes of color traveling within it, green, blue, violet, red, candy pink. It's the first real color I've seen in this world, he thought. Behind him, Bob Jenkins sprinted through the first class section, up the narrow aisle which led to the service area, and right into Nick's waiting arms.
Easy, mate, Nick soothed. Everything's going to be all right now.
No!
Bob struggled wildly, but Nick held him as easily as a man might hold a struggling kitten.
No, you don't understand. He's got to turn back. He's got to turn back before it's too late.
Nick pulled the rider away from the cockpit door and back into first class.
We'll just sit down here and belt up tight, shall we?
He said in the same soothing, chummy voice. It may be a trifle bumpy. To Brian, Nick's voice was only a faint blur of sound. As he entered the wide flow of vapor streaming into the time rep, he felt a large and immensely powerful hand seize the plane, dragging it eagerly forward. He found himself thinking of the leak on the flight from Tokyo to L.A., and of how fast air rushed out of a hole in a pressurized environment. It's as if this whole world, or what is left of it, is leaking through that hole, he thought. And then that queer and ominous phrase from his dream recurred again. Shooting stars only. The rip lay dead ahead of the 767's nose now, growing rapidly. We're going in, he thought. God help us, we're really going in. Bob continued to struggle as Nick pinned him in one of the first class seats with one hand and worked to fasten his seatbelt with the other. Bob was a small, skinny man, surely no more than 140 pounds soaking wet, but panic had animated him and he was making it extremely hard for Nick. We're really going to be all right, matey, Nick said. He finally managed to click Bob's seatbelt shut. We were when we came through, weren't we?
We were all asleep when we came through, you damn fool, Bob shrieked into his face. Don't you understand? We were asleep! You've got to stop him!
Nick froze in the act of reaching for his own belt. What Bob was saying, what he had been trying to say all along, suddenly struck him like a dropped load of bricks.
Oh, dear God, he whispered. Dear God, what were we thinking of?
He leaped out of his seat and dashed for the cockpit.
Brian, stop! Turn back! Turn back!
Brian had been staring into the rip, nearly hypnotized as they approached. There was no turbulence, but that sense of tremendous power, of air rushing into the hole like a mighty river, had increased. He looked down at his instruments and saw the 767's airspeed was increasing rapidly. Then Nick began to shout, and a moment later the Englishman was behind him, gripping his shoulders, staring at the rip as it swelled in front of the jet's nose, its play of deepening colors racing across his cheeks and brow, making him look like a man staring at a stained glass window on a sunny day. The steady thrumming sound had become dark thunder.
Turn back, Brian! You have to turn back!
Did Nick have a reason for what he was saying, or had Bob's panic been infectious? There was no time to make a decision on any rational basis, only a split second to consult the silent tickings of instinct. Brian grabbed the steering yoke and hauled it hard over to port. Nick was thrown across the cockpit and into the bulkhead. There was a sickening crack as his arm broke. In the main cabin, the luggage which had fallen from the overhead compartments when Brian swerved onto the runway at BIA now flew once more, striking the curved walls and thudding off the windows in a vicious hail. The man with the black beard was thrown out of his seat like a Cabbage Patch Kid and had time to utter one bleary squawk before his head collided with the arm of a seat and he fell into the aisle in an untidy tangle of limbs. Bethany screamed and Albert hugged her tight against him. Two rows behind, Rudy Warwick closed his eyes tighter, clutched his rosary harder, and prayed faster as his seat tilted away beneath him. Now there was turbulence. Flight 29 became a surfboard with wings, rocking and twisting and thumping through the unsteady air. Brian's hands were momentarily thrown off the yoke, and then he grabbed it again. At the same time, he opened the throttle all the way to the stop, and the plane's turbos responded with a deep snarl of power rarely heard outside of the airline's diagnostic hangars. The turbulence increased. The plane slammed viciously up and down, and from somewhere came the deadly shriek of overstressed metal. In first class, Bob Jenkins clutched at the arms of his seat, numbly grateful that the Englishman had managed to belt him in. He felt as if he had been strapped to some madman's jet-powered pogo stick. The plane took another great leap, rocked up almost to the vertical on its port side wing, and his false teeth shot from his mouth.
Are we going in? Dear Jesus, are we?
He didn't know. He only knew that the world was a thumping, bucking nightmare, but he was still in it. For the time being, at least, he was still in it. The turbulence continued to increase as Brian drove the 767 across the wide stream of vapor feeding into the rip. Ahead of him, the hole continued to swell in front of the plane's nose even as it continued sliding off to starboard.
Then, after one particularly vicious jolt, they came out of the rapids and into smoother air. The time rip disappeared to starboard. They had missed it, by how little Brian did not like to think.
He continued to bank the plane, but at a less drastic angle. "Nick!" he shouted without turning around. "Nick, are you all right?"
Nick got slowly to his feet, holding his right arm against his belly with his left hand. His face was very white, and his teeth were set in a grimace of pain. Small trickles of blood ran from his nostrils.
"I've been better, mate. Broke my arm, I think. Not the first time for this poor old fellow, either.
We missed it, didn't we?" "We missed it," Brian agreed. He continued to bring the plane back in a big, slow circle. "And in just a minute, you're going to tell me why we missed it. When we came all this way to find it, and it better be good, broken arm or no broken arm." He reached for the intercom toggle.
Laurel opened her eyes as Brian began to speak and discovered that Dinah's head was in her lap. She stroked her hair gently and then readjusted her position on the stretcher.
"This is Captain Engel, folks. I'm sorry about that. It was pretty damn hairy, but we're okay. I've got a green board. Let me repeat that we found what we were looking for, but..."
He clicked off suddenly. The others waited. Bethany Sims was sobbing against Albert's chest. Behind them, Rudy was still saying his rosary. Brian had broken his transmission when he realized that Bob Jenkins was standing beside him. The writer was shaking. There was a wet patch on his slacks. His mouth had an odd, sunken look Brian hadn't noticed before, but he seemed in charge of himself. Behind him, Nick sat heavily in the co-pilot's chair, wincing as he did so and still cradling his arm. It had begun to swell.
"What the hell is this all about?" Brian asked Bob sternly. "A little more turbulence and this bitch would have broken into about 10,000 pieces.
"Can I talk through that thing?" Bob asked, pointing to the switch marked intercom.
"Yes, but..."
"Then let me do it." Brian started to protest and thought better of it. He flicked the switch.
"Go ahead, you're on." Then he repeated, "And it better be good."
"Listen to me, all of you," Bob shouted. From behind them came a protesting whine of feedback.
"We..."
"Just talk in your normal tone of voice," Brian said. "You'll blow their goddamn eardrums out." Bob made a visible effort to compose himself, then went on in a lower tone of voice.
"We had to turn back, and we did. The captain has made it clear to me that we only just managed to do it. We have been extremely lucky, and extremely stupid as well. We forgot the most elementary thing, you see, although it was right in front of us all the time. When we went through the time rip in the first place, everyone on the plane who was awake disappeared."
Brian jerked in his seat. He felt as if someone had slugged him. Ahead of the 767's nose, about 30 miles distant, the faintly glowing lozenge shape had appeared again in the sky, looking like some gigantic, semi-precious stone. It seemed to mock him.
"We are all awake," Bob said.
In the main cabin, Albert looked at the man with the black beard lying out cold in the aisle and thought, with one exception.
"Logic suggests that if we try to go through that way, we will disappear."
He thought about this and then said,
"That is all."
Brian flicked the intercom link closed without thinking about it. Behind him, Nick voiced a painful, incredulous laugh.
"That is all. That is bloody all. What do we do about it?"
Brian looked at him and didn't answer. Neither did Bob Jenkins. Bethany raised her head and looked into Albert's strained, bewildered face.
"We have to go to sleep. How do we do that? I never felt less like sleeping in my whole life."
"I don't know." He looked hopefully across the aisle at Laurel. She was already shaking her head. She wished she could go to sleep. Just go to sleep and make this whole crazy nightmare gone. But like Bethany, she had never felt less like it in her entire life. Bob took a step forward and gazed out through the cockpit window in silent fascination. After a long moment, he said in a soft, awed voice,
"So that's what it looks like."
A line from some rock and roll song popped into Brian's head. "You can look, but you better not touch." He glanced down at the LED fuel indicators. What he saw there didn't ease his mind any. and he raised his eyes helplessly to Nick's. Like the others, he had never felt so wide awake in his life. "I don't know what we do now," he said, "but if we're going to try that hole, it has to be soon. The fuel we've got will carry us for an hour, maybe a little more. After that, forget it. Got any ideas?" Nick lowered his head, still cradling his swelling arm. After a moment or two, he looked up again. "Yes," he said. "As a matter of fact, I do. People who fly rarely stick their prescription medicine in their checked baggage. They like to have it with them in case their luggage ends up on the other side of the world and takes a few days to get back to them. If we go through the hand-carry bags, we're sure to find scads of sedatives. We won't even have to take the bags out of the bins. Judging from the sounds, most of them are already lying on the floor." "What? What's the matter with it?" This last was directed at Bob Jenkins, who had begun shaking his head as soon as the phrase "prescription medicines" popped out of Nick's mouth. "Do you know anything about prescription sedatives?" he asked Nick.
"A little," Nick said,
but he sounded defensive.
"A little, yeah."
"Well, I know a lot," Bob said dryly. "I've researched them exhaustively from All Night to Xanax. Murder by sleeping potion has always been a great favorite in my field, you understand. Even if you happen to find one of the more potent medications in the very first bag you checked, unlikely in itself, you couldn't administer a safe dose which would act quickly enough."
"Why bloody not?"
"Because it would take at least 40 minutes for the stuff to work. And I strongly doubt it would work on everyone. The natural reaction of minds under stress to such medication is to fight, to try to refuse it. There is absolutely no way to combat such a reaction, Nick. You might as well try to legislate your own heartbeat. What you'd do, always supposing you found a supply of medication large enough to allow it, would be to administer a series of lethal overdoses and turn the plane into Jonestown. We might all come through, but we'd be dead."
40 minutes, Nick said.
"Christ, are you sure? Are you absolutely sure?"
"Yes,"
Bob said unflinchingly.
Brian looked out at the glowing lozenge shape in the sky. He had put Flight 29 into a circling pattern, and the rip was on the verge of disappearing again. It would be back shortly, but they would be no closer to it.
"I can't believe it," Nick said heavily. "To go through the things we've gone through, to have taken off successfully and come all this way, to have actually found the bloody thing, and then we find out we can't go through it and back to our own time just because we can't go to sleep."
"We don't have 40 minutes anyway," Brian said quietly. "If we waited that long, this plane would crash 60 miles east of the airport."
"Surely there are other fields."
"There are, but none big enough to handle an airplane of this size."
"If we went through and then turned back east again?"
"Vegas.
But Vegas is going to be out of reach and..."
Brian glanced at his instruments.
"Less than 8 minutes. I think it has to be LAX. I'll need at least 35 minutes to get there. That's cutting it extremely fine. Even if they clear everything out of our way and vector us straight in, that gives us..."
He looked at the chronometer again.
20 minutes at most to figure this thing out and get through the hole."
Bob was looking thoughtfully at Nick.
"What about you?"
he asked.
"What do you mean, what about me?"
"I think you're a soldier, but I don't think you're an ordinary one. Might you be SAS, perhaps?"
Nick's face tightened. "And if I was that or something like that, mate?"
"Maybe you could put us to sleep," Bob said. "Don't they teach you special forces men tricks like that?"
Brian's mind flashed back to Nick's first confrontation with Craig Toomey.
"Have you ever watched Star Trek?"
he had asked Craig.
"Marvelous American program. And if you don't shut your gob at once, you bloody idiot, I'll be happy to demonstrate Mr. Spock's famous Vulcan sleeper hold for you."
"What about it, Nick?" Brian said softly. "If we ever needed the famous Vulcan sleeper hold, it's now." Nick looked unbelievingly from Bob to Brian, and then back to Bob again.
"Please don't make me laugh, gents. It makes my arm hurt worse."
"What does that mean?" Bob asked.
"I've got my sedatives all wrong, have I? Well, let me tell you both, you've got it all wrong about me. I am not James Bond. There never was a James Bond in the real world. I suppose I might be able to kill you with a neck chop, Bob, but I'd more likely just leave you paralyzed for life. Maybe not even knock you out. And then there's this.
Nick held up his rapidly swelling right arm with a little wince. My smart hand happens to be attached to my recently rebroken arm. I could perhaps defend myself with my left hand against an unschooled opponent, but the kind of thing you're talking about, no. No way.
You're all forgetting the most important thing of all,
a new voice said. They turned. Lowell Stevenson, white and haggard, was standing in the cockpit door. She had folded her arms across her breasts as if she was cold and was cupping her elbows in her hands.
If we're all knocked out, who's going to fly the plane? She asked. Who's going to fly the plane into L.A.?
The three men gaped at her wordlessly. Behind them, unnoticed, the large semi-precious stone that was the time rip glided into view again.
We're fucked, Nick said quietly. Do you know that? We are absolutely dead out fucked.
He laughed a little, then winced as his stomach jogged his broken arm.
Maybe not, Albert said. He and Bethany had appeared behind Laurel.
Albert had his arm around the girl's waist. His hair was plastered against his forehead in sweaty ringlets, but his dark eyes were clear and intent. They were focused on Brian.
I think you can put us to sleep, he said, and I think you can land us.
What are you talking about? Brian asked roughly.
Albert replied,
pressure. I'm talking about pressure.
Brian's dream recurred to him then, recurred with such terrible force that he might have been reliving it. Anne, with her hand plastered over the crack in the body of the plane, the crack with the words, shooting stars only, printed over it in red.
Pressure. See, darling, it's all taken care of.
What does he mean, Brian? Nick asked. I can see he's got something. Your face says so. What is it?
Brian ignored him. He looked steadily at the 17-year-old music student, who might just have thought of a way out of the box they were in. What about after, he asked.
What about after we come through? How do I wake up again so I can land the plane?
Will somebody please explain this, Laurel pleaded.
She had gone to Nick, who put his good arm around her waist. Albert is suggesting that I use this. Brian tapped a rheostat on the control board, a rheostat marked cabin pressure, to knock us all out cold.
Can you do that, mate? Can you really do that?
Yes, Brian said. I've known pilots, charter pilots, who have done it. When passengers who've had too much to drink started cutting up and endangering either themselves or the crew, knocking out a drunk by lowering the air pressure isn't that difficult. To knock out everyone, all I have to do is lower it some more, to half sea level pressure, say. It's like ascending to a height of 2 miles without an oxygen mask. Boom, you're out cold.
If you can really do that, why hasn't it been used on terrorists? Bob asked.
Because there are oxygen masks, right? Albert asked.
Yes, Brian said.
The cabin crew demonstrates them at the start of every commercial jet flight. Put the gold cup over your mouth and nose and breathe normally, right? They drop automatically when cabin pressure falls below 12 psi. If a hostage pilot tried to knock out a terrorist by lowering the air pressure, all the terrorist would have to do is grab a mask, put it on, and start shooting. On smaller jets like the Lear, that isn't the case. If the cabin loses pressure, the passenger has to open the overhead compartment himself. Nick looked at the chronometer. Their window was now only 14 minutes wide.
I think we best stop talking about it and just do it, he said. Time is getting very short.
Not yet, Brian said, and looked at Albert again. I can bring us back in line with the rip, Albert, and start decreasing pressure as we head toward it. I can control the cabin pressure pretty accurately, and I'm pretty sure I can put us all out before we go through. But that leaves Laurel's question. Who flies the airplane if we're all knocked out? Albert opened his mouth, closed it again, and shook his head. Bob Jenkins spoke up then. His voice was dry and toneless, the voice of a judge pronouncing doom.
I think you can fly us home, Brian. But someone else will have to die in order for you to do it.
Explain, Nick said crisply.
Bob did so. It didn't take long. By the time he finished, Rudy Warwick had joined the little group standing in the cockpit door.
Would it work, Brian? Nick asked.
Yes, Brian said absently. No reason why not. He looked at the chronometer again.
11 minutes now. 11 minutes to get across to the other side of the rip. It would take almost that long to line the plane up, program the autopilot, and move them along the 40-mile approach. But who's going to do it? Do the rest of you draw straws or what? No need for that, Nick said. He spoke lightly, almost casually. I'll do it. No, Laurel said. Her eyes were very wide and very dark. Why you? Why does it have to be you?
Shut up, Bethany hissed at her. If he wants to, let him.
Albert glanced unhappily at Bethany, at Laurel, and then back at Nick. A voice, not a very strong one, was whispering that he should have volunteered, that this was a job for a tough Alamo survivor like the Arizona Jew. But most of him was only aware that he loved life very much and did not want it to end just yet. So he opened his mouth and then closed it again without speaking.
Why you? Laurel asked again urgently. Why shouldn't we draw straws? Why not Bob or Rudy? Why not me?
Nick took her arm. Come with me a moment, he said. Nick, there's not much time, Brian said. He tried to keep his tone of voice even, but he could hear desperation, perhaps even panic, bleeding through.
I know. Start doing the things you have to do.
Nick drew Laurel through the door. She resisted for a moment, then came along. He stopped in the small galley alcove and faced her. In that moment, with his face less than 4 inches from hers, she realized a dismal truth. He was the man she had been hoping to find in Boston. He had been on the plane all the time. There was nothing at all romantic about this discovery. It was horrible.
I think we might have had something, you and me, he said. You think I could be right about that?
If you do, say so.
There's no time to dance. Absolutely none.
Yes, she said. Her voice was dry, uneven. I think that's right.
But we don't know. We can't know. It all comes back to time, doesn't it? Time, and sleep, and not knowing. But I have to be the one, Laurel. I've tried to keep some reasonable account of myself, and all my books are deeply in the red. This is my chance to balance them. And I mean to take it.
I don't understand what you mean.
No, but I do.
He spoke fast, almost rapping his words. Now he reached out, took her forearm, and drew her even closer to him.
You were on an adventure of some sort, weren't you, Laurel?
I don't know what you're...
He gave her a brisk shake.
I told you, there's no time to dance. Were you on an adventure?
Yes.
Nick!
Brian called from the cockpit. Nick looked rapidly in that direction.
Coming,
he shouted, and then looked back at Laurel. I'm going to send you on another one. If you get out of this, that is, and if you agree to go. She only looked at him, her lips trembling. She had no idea of what to say. Her mind was tumbling helplessly. His grip on her arm was very tight, but she would not be aware of that until later when she saw the bruises left by his fingers. At that moment, the grip of his eyes was much stronger.
Listen, listen carefully.
He paused and then spoke with peculiar, measured emphasis.
I was going to quit it. I'd made up my mind.
Quit what? She asked in a small, quivery voice.
Nick shook his head impatiently.
Doesn't matter. What matters is whether or not you believe me, do you?
Yes, she said. I don't know what you're talking about, but I believe you mean it.
Nick, Brian warned from the cockpit. We're heading toward it.
She shot a glance toward the cockpit again, his eyes narrow and gleaming.
Coming just now,
he called. When he looked at her again, Laurel thought she had never in her life been the focus of such ferocious, focused intensity.
My father lives in the village of Fluting, south of London, he said. Ask for him in any shop along the high street. Mr. Hopewell. The older ones still call him the gaffer. Go to him and tell him I'd made up my mind to quit it. You'll need to be persistent. He tends to turn away and curse loudly when he hears my name. The old I have no son bit. Can you be persistent?
Yes.
He nodded and smiled grimly.
Good.
Repeat what I've told you, and tell him you believed me. Tell him I tried my best to atone for the day behind the church in Belfast.
In Belfast?
Right. And if you can't get him to listen any other way, tell him he must listen. Because of the daisies.
The time I brought the daisies. Can you remember that as well?
Because once you brought him daisies?
Nick seemed to almost laugh. but she had never seen a face filled with such sadness and bitterness. No, not to him, but it'll do. That's your adventure. Will you do it?
Yes, but...
Good, Laurel. Thank you. He put his left hand against the nape of her neck, pulled her face to his, and kissed her. His mouth was cold, and she tasted fear on his breath. A moment later, he was gone.